This podcast is going to be a rehearsal of the speech that I'm going to give to the Bonneville School of Sailing on February 20th, 2014. Now, what you're not going to see on this is the visual slides that I'm showing, but you'll hear basically what I think I'm going to be talking about. Now, this is impromptu. I'm just working from a rough outline, so there'll be mistakes along the way, and that's okay. So here we go. I want to thank Todd Fry for inviting me to speak today. I think he's doing a great job with the Bonneville School of Sailing in putting on these winter lecture series. If I lived in Provo, I would be down here going to all of them, but it's quite a drive to get down here from Salt Lake, and at the time they're put on, I'd be fighting traffic, and I don't like to do that. But I'm glad to come down here and talk to you about some of my experiences in sailing. And I'll tell you a little bit about myself and how I got into it. Now, my initial thought was I was going to go over last summer's trip, the islands I visited last summer. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought it's probably better just to talk about stories and anecdotes and experiences I've had over the last 15 years of sailing in the Mediterranean and how I ended up doing what I'm doing. When I was a teenager, National Geographic came out with a series of articles about Robin Graham, a young man who at the age of 16 years old set off to sail around the world. And I think he started out in a Catalina 27, not a particularly seaworthy boat for extended voyages, but that's what he had, and that's what they went with, or well, that's what he went with. National Geographic, every 6 months, might have another article about where he had sailed, what he had done. And this series of articles captured my imagination. Now, my family never really had the opportunity to travel. My mother was a school teacher, and my father was an engineer, and we didn't have a lot of excess funds for traveling. But I always wanted to travel. And I was envious of my uncle and my cousins who lived in exotic locations. He worked for the government, the Department of Agriculture, and he spent a few years living in Ethiopia. Then he spent a few years living in Thailand. And he would come back at Christmas and show us slides of these places it had been to, and I was so envious. Well, I wanted to travel. And this series of articles about Robin Graham and the National Geographic spurred my imagination, and I decided I wanted to travel by sail. I wanted to be a sailor. Now, I'd never had the opportunity to sail, didn't know anything about it, didn't know if I'd get seasick or not, but that was a dream that was sparked as a young man reading this series of articles. Well, I never even saw the ocean till I was in college, and eventually I met a woman, my wife, Kay, and I told her my dream, and she was very supportive of it. She said, "Great, I'll support you on that dream. That's no problem with me." And so I never really had the opportunity to sail, though. I mean, I had done everything I could. I'd read every book I could on sailing. I'd gotten my ham radio license because I knew that the only way to communicate when I'm out there in the middle of the ocean is with amateur radio. I'd done that. I'd read every book. I was taking the Cruising World magazines. I was doing everything I could to learn about sailing, but I'd never really had any practical knowledge of sailing. Well, my wife went to a book club or a church group one time and came home and said, "Hey, one of the members of the church group, her husband is looking for crew on his sailboat on the Great Salt Lake." I said, "Wow." So I called him up. His name was Mike Seedahl. He owns a company called Advanced Materials Handling in Salt Lake. It sells forklifts and materials handling equipment. And I called Mike up and I said, "Mike, I'd love to be on your crew." He said, "Come on out." So I started sailing with Mike, and we sailed weekends, and we sailed Wednesday night races, and over the years, I pretty much learned every position on the boat. And I always tell people that the best way to learn to sail is to get on a racing crew, because you will make all the mistakes that you're going to make eventually in a shorter period of time and at somebody else's expense. Racing sailors are used to writing big checks. If they want to be competitive, they're buying new sails, they're buying new gears all the time. So I learned to sail. Mike was my mentor. During this period of time, One of my friends in Logan, Dave Harris, was building a house for a man named Lynn Leisure. Lynn Leisure started and was operating a company called South Pacific Yacht Charters, which has since been sold to Moorings. Well, at the time Lynn was building this house, Dave made a deal with him that for part of the cost of building this house, I think part of the labor, they did an exchange of services for labor, that Dave would be able to take one of his boats, one of his charter boats, out for 2 weeks and out of Raiatea. It was the island of Raiatea in the French Polynesian Islands. But Dave didn't know how to sail, so he called me up and said, "Franz, I know you're sailing. Why don't you come with me and sail this boat?" So that was the first opportunity my wife and I had to really take our own boat out along with Dave and his wife and sail the South Pacific Islands. We had a wonderful time. Trade winds sailing. We had a couple squalls. First night was pretty stormy and rainy. But we had a great time and we snorkeled. And I've been spoiled ever since because every time somebody raves about the underwater life in the Caribbean, I just think it's like a desert compared to the South Pacific. And of course, the Mediterranean, where I sail now, is like a desert compared to the Caribbean. There's very little marine life that you see when snorkeling in the Mediterranean. That's just another side note, though. But anyway, we chartered a boat there. A couple of years later, we had the opportunity to charter a boat in Greece. I took my parents and my sister and her husband, and we chartered a boat in Greece. And then later on, we chartered a boat in the U.S. and British Virgin Islands. We actually chartered in the U.S. Virgin Islands, but spent most of the time sailing in the British Virgin Islands. And during this time, I was searching around for a Holland deck to build a boat. I decided I could not afford to buy the type of boat that I wanted. I wanted to have a boat that would be capable of sailing anywhere in the world. Those boats aren't cheap. And I knew I couldn't really afford to buy a boat new. And I wasn't willing to go in debt because the whole point of having a boat was to have the freedom that comes with the owning of a boat and not have to make monthly payments or work to support a boat. So during this period of time, I had looked around and looked around and looked around, finally settled on a design. And if you've ever read the Seraphim Adventures, Larry and Lynn Party, that's the boat I chose, a Lyle Hess-designed Bristol Channel Cutter. So the boat was delivered up to my house. It was basically a bathtub. I did have the builder, Sam Moore's company of Costa Mesa, California, put in three bulkheads that I could not get in through the hatch, and I had him attach the deck to the hull, so I didn't have to worry about doing the hull deck joint. But other than that, it was a big, empty bathtub. It had no sole, it had no engine, it had no wiring, it had no ballast, it had nothing. And I got on this boat and I looked and I would scratch my head every time I got in there, and the job just felt so overwhelming when I got it. But I just decided to start concentrating on one thing at a time, and eventually it took me 5 years, but it was built, and it was built well. I'm very proud of the boat. It's a beautiful boat. I made a lot of mistakes in building the boat, but I got better as I went along. It was launched in Bellingham, Washington, I think in 1994. Well, maybe in 1993. I spent 5 years sailing up in the Northwest, just absolutely gorgeous, wonderful sailing. When you're sailing in the Northwest, you learn how to read current tables, and you learn how to plan your passages with the tides, because if you don't, you never go anywhere. And it can get fairly dangerous if you don't know what you're doing up there. So we sailed up there for 5 years, absolutely loved it. And we probably would have continued just doing this and putting off the dream of traveling by sail, except a tragedy happened. I had two very close friends growing up in Logan. One of them was Dave Harris, and the other one was John Williams. And John was killed in an automobile accident. And I went up to his funeral, and what I heard at the funeral were all the things that John wanted to do in life, all the things he wanted to do, all his plans in life, cut short by an untimely accident. And it made me think, and it made me think very seriously, that I had planned to do the transoceanic voyage at some point in time. I wanted to travel by sailboat, and I made my mind up that night that I wasn't going to put off my dream any longer. So I went home to my wife and I said, hey, we're going to do this year. She said, well, you know, maybe it's not quite right. Maybe the time's not right. We had two daughters, twin daughters, and I think they were around 10 years old at the time. My wife will correct me on this. She knows these details, but they were around 10 years old. She said, someday. I said, no, it's not going to be someday. It's going to be this year, and you can choose to support me or not, but we're going to do it. Well, bless her heart, she chose to support me. She made me get a little more life insurance, but she said, okay, let's do it. And it was really, I sat down and I went through our finances with her. She said, we don't really have the wherewithal to do it right now. I said, well, what's the number we need? And we really did. I mean, people somehow give up their dreams in the quest for more money. When they have the money to achieve their dreams, they still keep trying to get more money. And that was the pattern we might have found ourselves in. I mean, don't get us wrong, we weren't wealthy, but we were making ends meet. My wife always worked full-time as a nurse, and I was working full-time as a stockbroker at the time, a securities broker at the time. And I decided to take 5 months off and cross an ocean. She said, okay, I guess we'll do it. So that's what we did. In 1997, in April of 97, I sailed across the Atlantic. It was a rough passage. My first crew abandoned me in the Azores. They didn't really abandon me. One of the crew members was injured. He was hurt. He hurt his arm fairly seriously on the boat when we were in some rough weather, and he reached out and kept the other crew member from falling overboard. So they left me in the Azores. It was a pretty rough passage, 18 of the 22 days to the Azores. It was in stormy weather. And so I had a new crew come out and join me in the Azores, an older man, Paul Bauer, 72 years old at the time, or 70 years old at the time, and another man from St. George. And we had just a delightful sail from the Azores to Portugal. They left me in Portugal. I got in the boat, sailed just down the coast from Lagos, Portugal, to Portimão, Portugal. And during that period of time, my auto helm broke. So I got on the dinghy, went ashore, and called my wife and told her to bring me over a new auto helm. And that night, I was able to fix the old auto helm. It was basically a small thing, a screw that had come loose and was not holding the flux gate compass down. But anyway, I fixed that. And that began our adventure of sailing in the Mediterranean. So that's how I got to sailing in the Mediterranean. Now let's talk about why I chose the Mediterranean as opposed to the Caribbean or Mexico or the South Pacific. Because sailing in the Mediterranean is miserable sailing. There's either too much wind or too little wind. It's not like the trade wind sailing that you have in the Caribbean or the South Pacific, where you put up your sails and you just forget about it for days on end. No, the Mediterranean, you're always playing with your sails. And it depends on what part of the Mediterranean you're sailing in. The wind patterns differ a lot throughout the different regions of the Mediterranean. The Adriatic has a totally different weather pattern than the Aegean. The lower Adriatic around the Ionian Islands is totally different than the weather patterns off of Croatia. The Aegean has, in the summer, Meltemis, which are extremely strong, can get to be extremely strong winds that come out of the north, northeast, or northwest, and can blow for, I've been stuck in port for a week at a time. Well, I gave this decision to my wife. I said, I'm going to do a transoceanic passage. You choose which direction we want to go. Are we going to go to the South Pacific, or are we going to go to the Mediterranean or the Caribbean? Where do you want to go? Without any hesitation, she chose the Mediterranean. And the reason she chose the Mediterranean is the right reasons, because we are travelers first, sailors second. We like the culture. We like the variety of the culture in the Mediterranean. And we've absolutely loved it. Now, I've sailed a lot in the Caribbean. And here's my complaint of the Caribbean. First of all, every sailor in the Caribbean has to chain up his dinghy and chain up his outboard to the dinghy. There's tremendous theft in the Caribbean. Every resort you go into, you have a contrast of poverty on one side and five-star resorts on the other side. It's a Disneyland. It's a false premise, in my opinion. I wanted to go to where they didn't develop this waterfront resort for me. It's been there for thousands of years, and it was designed for commerce. And usually the cities started the waterfront and worked back. And we've never been disappointed by the variety of cultures that we've been able to experience in the Mediterranean. The South Pacific, it's beautiful. But I'll be quite honest, after 2 weeks chartering a boat in the South Pacific, I was sort of bored of beautiful tropical paradises over and over every day. There really wasn't much culture. There was Polynesian culture, but that's one culture. In the Mediterranean, you have a variety of cultures, and we've really enjoyed it. Now, I'm going to talk about some stories, some short stories of things that have occurred over the years that are memorable. And if anybody has any questions, feel free to pop in and ask along the way. We'll have a question and answer period at the end of this talk. But if you have questions along the way, just go ahead and ask. Let's talk about the kindness of strangers. Got a few stories to talk about. Now, a lot of these stories are related to land-based travel and not necessarily sailing. But that's why we're over there, is for the land-based travel on our sailboat. The family and I had been in Salerno. The boat was in Salerno, Italy. We'd spent a long day visiting the ruins of Pompeii. It was just a short train ride north of Salerno. South of Naples, but north of Salerno. So Pompeii was between the two cities, or is between the two cities. We'd spent all day walking around the ruins, and we'd taken the train back to the bus, or to the train station in Salerno. And I noticed the marina, the yacht club that we'd left the boat at, was about a mile away from the train station. And at the train station, they had all these buses. I thought, well, let's just take the bus back instead of walking back. So I don't speak Italian, don't read Italian. My wife is better with languages than I am. But I'd go up to the bus driver and say, Porta Maior. That was the name of the port, Porta Maior, major port. And one would say no, and we found one that said, yes, I'm going to Porta Maior. Now, we got on the bus, and we started going down towards the port, and it went right by the port, but it was about three blocks above the port. And I thought, well, okay, we'll just stay on the bus because eventually it'll go in a circle and it'll come back down and it'll go right by the port, right by the yacht club, and we'll get off there on the way back. And this is probably about 7, 8 in the evening. And so we start riding on this bus. We just wait for it to come around and do its route. And pretty soon, we're way up in the mountains, and we're the last people on the bus, and I go up to the bus driver, and I say, Porta Maior, and his eyes go up, his eyebrows goes up, he turns around and looks back at my family, starts saying something in Italian, and turns the bus around and brings us right back to the port. Doesn't stop for anybody. People are trying to wave down the bus, but he doesn't stop. Obviously, he was on his way back for the night. He was obviously going home for the night. We messed with his problems. He turned around and brought the boat right back. I've had the boat in various ports in Turkey, up and down the coast of Turkey. A couple of years, I left it in a town called Ayvalık, which is in on the northern part of the coast of Turkey. The only problem with leaving the boat in Ayvalık, there's no easy way to get there. And it's usually about a 6-hour bus ride to get there. Well, I'd been in and out of Turkey for quite a number of years, and I got off the plane and I went straight to the bus station, and I told the bus driver, I said, I found a bus that was heading down to Ayvalık, but they let me know that I was going to have to change the bus in a couple locations. Now, I don't speak Turkish, and they didn't speak English, but they made me understand that I would have to be changing the bus. So I say, fine, I get on the bus, and I'm fighting jet lag at the time because I've been flying all night long. And get on the bus, and it starts heading down. And pretty much all day long, I think I left on the bus around 2 or 3 in the afternoon. At about 10 o'clock at night, I arrive in a city that's a little ways away from Ivalik. And the bus driver lets me know that I have to get off here. And so I get off there, and I walk into the bus station, and it's pretty much closed down. There's one kiosk that's open. And I go up to the kiosk, and I say, I'm looking to get to Ivalik. And he says, oh, too late, too late. I said, oh, no, I need to get to Ivalik. And he said, oh, okay, well, he indicated for me to go and sit down. And I went and sat down for a while, and after a while of sitting down, I got up and started wandering around again. He came over to me and told me, go sit down. So I went back and sat down, and I was sitting there for a while. Pretty soon he comes over to me and says, okay, motions for me to follow him. So I follow him out, and we're standing on the curb. And pretty soon a bus comes by. He talks to the bus driver, tells him what I need. I get on the bus. Bus doesn't charge me anything. The bus driver doesn't charge me anything and takes me to Ivalik. Another time, I was in Safranbolu in the middle of Turkey. It's a World Heritage Site. It's known for its Ottoman houses. I was standing around, two stories in Safranbolu. I was standing around trying to figure out how to get to the older section of town, and a man comes up to me. He says, can I help you? And I said, well, I'm trying to find the older section of town where the Ottoman houses are. And he spoke reasonably good English, and very few other people in the town spoke English. He says, okay, I will find you a way down there. So he waits, and he waits, and he waits with me as these dolmishes go by. Now, dolmishes are just little mini buses that go everywhere in Turkey. You can get anywhere you want to go in Turkey on dolmishes. So he waits and waits and he waits and he finds the right one. He knows what one to look for, and he talks to the driver and he tells him where I'm going and he pays my fare. In fact, that happened many times in Turkey. Many times people would come up and ask me what I needed and make sure I was well taken care of. The Turks really are wonderful people. So I spent a few days in Safranbolu and I'm heading back to Istanbul because my flight is out. The boat's been put up and I give myself a little time to do some inland travel, and I was doing my inland travel and I needed to get back to Istanbul to catch my flight back to Salt Lake. So the bus leaves early in the morning, and so I get down to the bus station in time, and it's the platform is being bathed in this brilliant hot sun. And I said, I don't want to stand here and sweat. So I just sort of walk down to the end of the building and stand in the shade. And I'm reading a book. And I poke my head around there, and the bus has come and gone. I run into the bus station. I said, my bus has come and gone. They said, oh, okay. Well, they get on the phone. They call the bus driver up. They tell him that he left me behind. Another bus is leaving. They say, get on that bus, and I hop on that bus. And this bus takes me down to the next city, and there at the bus station, my bus, the one that I need to get back to Istanbul, is sitting there waiting for me. It takes me to Istanbul. I was traveling along the north coast of Turkey. I wanted to look at the Black Sea to see if I wanted to take my boat up and go into the Black Sea. And I decided I didn't want to. There were very few facilities for yacht sailors. The Black Sea is one of the most polluted bodies of water. I think actually the most polluted body of salt water in the world. And I decided not to go up there. But nonetheless, I wanted to go and check out this part of the country. So I took a flight up to Trabzon from Antalya. And then I took a bus all the way, took various buses all the way along the northern coast of Turkey to a town to the east of Samsun. Then I caught a bus from there heading back down to Safranbolu. Along the way, there was an older couple on the bus, and the gentleman was ill. He kept vomiting into a bag, and the bus driver was concerned for his health. We stop at a clinic in a small town in the middle of Turkey, and everybody just gets off the bus and they take the gentleman into the clinic. We just wait. Eventually, I don't know what happened, if they gave him some drugs to help him to control his nausea or what, but he eventually comes out. It took about a half hour, 45 minutes, and then we get up back on the bus and head into Turkey. Just wonderful people. The Turks are wonderful people. I really enjoy the Turks. I could go on and on about the kindness we've experienced from strangers throughout the years of sailing in the Mediterranean. One time my daughter got dysentery and was well taken care of when we were staying in an area called Cappadocia in a town called Gourame. She ended up having to get some special drugs to control a dysentery, and I think she also got some fluids intravenously at the hospital. The Turk people take care of you. They always take care of you. On one of my inland trips, I visited a town called Afyon. Afyon is known as the largest or the second largest legitimate opiate manufacturers in the world. They grow poppies, opium poppies, for the pharmaceutical industries. And I'd read about this, and I thought, well, this sounds like an interesting place to visit. And the reason I wanted to visit it is it was known for its Afyon cream. I wanted to go taste the Afyon cream. And the only place you're going to taste Afyon cream is in Afyon, because they don't make that much of it that it is exported. This is Afyon cream in this photograph here. That's a man that comes in and sells the cream that he makes from his dairy cattle on a daily basis. Well, I got off the bus, and I wanted to get to a section of town that had a hotel. I was using Let's Go, I think, as my guidebook, and it talked about a hotel that was within my price range, which is always cheap. And I got off the bus, and I didn't know where to go. So I've learned over the years that it doesn't matter if you don't speak Turkish. They'll figure it out for you. So I pick a man at random, probably 20, 25-year-old man that's outside his house doing something. I don't remember what he was doing, but I walked up to him and I told him I needed to go to this hotel. And of course, he didn't understand me, so he said, well, come with me, follow me. So we go over and find a friend of his that speaks a little more English. They didn't quite understand me then. So we go over, and there's another friend of theirs that they start talking to that speaks more English. And I explain to him what I'm where I'm trying to go and what I'm trying to do. And I show them the name of the hotel that I'm going to in the guidebook. And they call up the hotel and nobody answers. And they said, well, okay. So they pick up my luggage and they say, follow us. So I follow them. They escort me to where the hotel used to be. Well, it had closed down. But they had gotten me to the section of town that I wanted to be in. That was okay. That was close enough. There were other hotels in the area. I just chose another hotel, but they take care of you. All right, let's get on to a few sailing stories here. One year I was sailing down from mainland Greece, and we had visited the island of Syros and then heading over to Mykonos. Outside of Syros, we were pulled over by a Greek customs boat. It was rough weather. It was windy, and the harbor is a very big ferry harbor. A lot of ferries going in and out of this harbor. In fact, it's the main ferry hub in the Kyklades Islands. So we're pulled over by a customs boat. I'm with my friend Jeff Shields, an attorney in Salt Lake, and another attorney, Rick Canute. And the customs boat asks for our papers. We're out in the middle of the harbor here. We're tied up next to the customs boat, floating free in the middle of the harbor, being bounced around quite a bit. Give him our papers, our passports, and he's dickering with them. And he says, okay, follow me over and come into the office over there. And I say, hey, what's going on? You have a problem? Is there something wrong with our papers? It's very dangerous to tie up the boat at this harbor in these conditions. What's going on? And he eventually just gives the papers back and says, okay, go on your way. I'm not sure what he was looking for, whether he was looking for a bribe or whatever. Trouble with Americans is we don't know how to do bribes. We don't know how to make bribes. It's not in our culture. Anyway, we get over to Mykonos, and Mykonos is known for not having particularly good holding in the marina. The marina is about 2 miles outside of the town of Mykonos, so you have to leave your boat and go into Mykonos if you want to go visit Mykonos. So we pull in, and there's a British boat on, as we're backing in, there's a British boat on our starboard side, and a American design Grand Banks power cruiser on our left side. We back in and people get off their boat and help take our stern lines. Med mooring's a real trick if you haven't done it. You'll learn it very quickly when you go over to the Mediterranean. You drop your anchor and you back in and then you tie off your stern lines to the shore. So we pull in, and when we pull in, the wind is coming from our stern. So the wind is blowing our boat away from the concrete quay. And we think we have a good tug on our anchor. We think we've got a good bite on the anchor. And we head off and go to town and go have dinner. And when we come back, the wind has shifted 180 degrees, blowing pretty strong on our nose. I get back to the boat, and my boat had been sprung from my stern to the bow by the British boat. He had seen that I was going to start crashing into the quay, that my anchor was not being held, and he sprang my boat off to keep me from hitting the concrete quay with his boat. Get back to the boat. It's dark now, and the wind is strong, but not real strong. We go out, we reset our anchor, we come back in, and we have a good anchor bite the second time. I drop more chain out, I go farther out, drop more chain out, and we have a good bite. Well, throughout the night, the wind starts building and building and building right on my nose. I'm sleeping in the cockpit. And up and down the quay, all hell's broke loose. My boat is being held well, so I feel I can get off my boat and go help the other boats. What I found really interesting was throughout the night, and this went on all night long, nobody raised their voices. Everybody was trying to be as helpful as they could. Well, there was one boat, beautiful new Italian boat, that was just, everybody was by this boat trying to push it off. Of course, one of the reasons they were by it, there's a attractive Italian woman running around in her panties, but that was just a side benefit. Everybody was trying to keep this boat from hitting the quay, from hitting the concrete. And the Italian skipper obviously was a new sailor. He really didn't know how to set his anchor, and he didn't know how to what to do. And finally, people said, hey, you've got to go and reset your anchor. You've got to go out and drop your anchor again and come back in. And so he said, okay. So we release his stern lines, and he starts his engine, and he pulls out, but he doesn't pull up his anchor. So what happens is he pops up all these other anchors to other boats that are really set well along the way, and there's just a big mess of line hung up on his anchor chain. He's popped off all these other anchors of all the other boats that had been secure up until that point in time. Well, a rescue operation is mounted. Some people get in some dinghies and go out and start helping him untangle this mess. Meanwhile, all the other boats that had just lost their anchorage had to go out and reset. This is in the dark. This is in the middle of the night. What amazed me was nobody raised their voice. Everybody was calm and collected and as helpful as they could be to every other sailor. Well, Kevin Alsop, he was the skipper of the Grand Banks boat. He had a desalinator on board, so he offered to fill up our water tanks, which is always a big issue. And we did that. And we head off, and we head down to Naxos, Ios, and Santorini, and Jeff and Rick get off in Santorini. And I head back up. My next crew is going to be joining me in Mykonos again. And this is during one of those weeks when I give myself some time to sail by myself. So I leave Santorini, and I work my way up to Ios, spend a night in Ios, and then I head over to the island of Paros. I always get Poros and Paros mixed up, but the island of Paros, and I spend 4 or 5 days there when a big storm goes by. And I pull into this harbor in Poros, and as I'm pulling into this harbor, there's a big boat there called the Sir Winston Churchill. Big, beautiful boat. Big, big, classic, old boat. And I came to find it was one of the British sailors' training vessels. As I'm pulling in, the people on that boat are watching me pull in, and I'm by myself, and I pull into the harbor, and I drop my anchor, and I come back, and I'm sitting in the cockpit reading a book. And the skipper of this boat comes by and says, are you by yourself? And I said, yeah, I'm by myself. He said, why don't you come over for drinks tonight? So I did, and they had invited me over because they thought they were making up stories about what I was doing. They watched me come in. They were making up stories of what I was doing, and they were convinced that I was on the lam, that I was running from the mafia. They had made up some really extravagant stories, but none of it was true. I was just sailing by myself, waiting to pick up my next crew back in Mykonos. He was one of the Greek shipping, he was from a Greek shipping family. He owned a company, a dry bulk shipping company. Pleasant evening with them. I sail on back to Mykonos. As I'm sailing in, Kevin Alsop on the Grand Banks is still sitting there waiting for his owner, the owner of the boat, to come and go sailing. I said, Kevin, what are you doing here still? He said, well, I've been here. The skipper said he was going to be here any day, any day, any day. And, of course, I've been out sailing for a week and a half since I saw him the last time. He said, you know, if I talk to people back in North Carolina, and that's where he was from, and I tell them that I was stuck on my boat for a week and a half in Mykonos, they won't have any sympathy for me. I said, I have sympathy for you. It's one of the most boring things in the world just to be stuck on your boat and not be able to go anywhere. Final story, and then I'm going to take some questions. I told you about the story in Salerno, where I needed to pick my next crew up down in Sicily. And so I do a little bit of inland travel, and I get back to the boat, and I need to get down to Porto Rosso on the north coast of Sicily to meet my next crew. My next crew member is going to be Norman Jewison and his girlfriend Lynn St. James. Norman was in Sicily for the Taormina Film Festival to get the Diamond Award for his movie Jesus Christ Superstar. But that's another story, and I don't know if I'm going to have time to tell that story, but we'll just finish up with this story and then take some questions. So I head out from Salerno. I need to head down to Sicily. I thought, well, I'm just going to sail out to Capri and spend the night in Capri and then get up early the next day and sail on down to Sicily. And along the way, I'll go through the Aeolian Islands. There's a group of islands just to the north of Sicily called the Aeolian Islands. Now, Aeolian means windy. Windy Islands. Well, there was no wind the day I headed down. I get up early in the morning and I start motoring, and it's a hot, hot day. And I stop a couple times during the day. I'm by myself and I go swimming because it is so hot. Here, I'm out of sight of land. I just stop the boat and I jump in the water and go swimming. Whenever I do this, I always make sure I have a long line with a bumper attached to it, so in case the boat started drifting away, I'd be able to get back to the boat. That wasn't a problem. There was no wind this day. Well, I'm trying to stay awake. It's over 100 miles of open ocean to get to the to get to Sicily, and it's about 3 in the morning, and I'm trying to stay awake. And I need to take a piss. So I go up to the shrouds. I always hold on to the shrouds to pee overboard. I don't like to go off the back because there's nothing to hold on to. When I go up to the shrouds, I can hold on to the shrouds and with two arms and pee overboard. So I walk up to the shrouds and I pee overboard, and as I'm looking forward, suddenly there's a red light right in front of me. Right in front of me. I run back to the cockpit. I put the boat in neutral. I watch this red light and it goes off. Wow, that's strange. So I stop the engine. I look around. I can't hear anything, but I know I saw this light. So I start the engine up and continue on my way, put the auto helm back on auto helm, and I start heading down again. About another half hour later goes by, and I see this red light again directly in front of me. Looks like about 200 yards in front of me. I stop the motor, stop the engine, listen, nothing, goes out. Well, about every half hour I see this light again, and it's not till the break of dawn that I realize what is happening. I'm heading straight through the chain of the Aeolian Islands, and the northernmost of this chain of the Aeolian Islands is Stromboli, the island of Stromboli. And the volcano on the island of Stromboli has been erupting about every 30 minutes for hundreds of years. And I went back and looked in the log, and sure, there was a little paragraph that I had missed that told me this occurred. But it was much more enjoyable solving the mystery by myself. I had picked up Norman Jewison in Porto Rosa after the film festival, and we sailed north to the island of Volcano on the first night. There was no wind when we arrived. It was very calm. The pilot said that the anchorage in Volcano was not good and to only use it on settled weather. Well, figuring the weather was settled, we went ahead and anchored in the one semi-protected anchorage on the island. As the sun went down, the wind started to build, and it built and built and built throughout the night. We were now on a lee shore. The wind was coming right at our nose, and we were being pushed back. The chop was bad. Previously, I had taken some fairly good readings in case I had to leave in the middle of the night. But my attitude is, as long as I'm just uncomfortable and not in danger, I'll stay where I am. I had one anchor out, the CQR, the 35-pound CQR, my main anchor on the boat. And I spent the night in the cockpit because I wanted to be able to watch to see if I was dragging. It was me and every other captain on the boats anchored around me that were up that night. Nobody was sleeping. Everybody was watching to make sure that they weren't dragging. The boat on my starboard got up in the middle of the night. He went forward, and he let out a bunch of anchor chain. The theory being, the more the scope on the chain, the better your holding power, because the more horizontal the pull on your anchor. Well, I learned something that night. I learned that it's okay to let more anchor chain out, but do it very slowly in a controlled manner. What he did is he went forward, he let a bunch of anchor chain out all at once, and what I saw occur was the boat started sliding backwards until it got to the end of the new anchor chain that had been let out, and it had momentum at that point in time, and it popped the anchor free. Now, I don't know why this skipper didn't do it, but very slowly, ever so slowly, his boat just dragged ashore. And in the morning, it was up on its side on the shore. It was a sandy shore with a few rocks in it, not really dangerous. It was a fairly safe shore to slide up on, and his boat was a steel boat. But I don't know why he didn't just start his engine and motor forward to stop the sliding down onto the shore. But he didn't. The next morning, he hired a couple boats to come out and tow him off, and he was embarrassed, and he had a few scratches on his boat, but his boat was okay, and he continued on his sailing. The week I spent with Norman and Lynn in the Aeolian Islands was the most uncomfortable, worst weather I've had with any guests in the entire 14 years I've been sailing in the Mediterranean. After we left Volcano the next morning, the weather died down, and we sailed around the island of Lipari, and we came back in and anchored in the town of Lipari on the island of Lipari. Very surgy tie-up at the quay. It was very surgy. There was a lot of surge in and out and in and out. And at the time, I had a hand windlass. I did not have an electric windlass at the time. So anytime I let my chain out, anytime I let my anchor out, I had to let it out and pull it up by hand. I didn't have any electric windlass at the time. And it was this experience that made me more convinced than ever to make sure I had an electric windlass on the boat. We were fine for a couple nights. The wind had built up, and we were pretty much stuck in Lipari. It was the only relatively safe anchorage in all of the Aeolian Islands. When the weather finally broke, we sailed on up to Isla Pinara. I think it's spelled P-A-N-A-R-E-A. And anchored there, one of the few anchorages on the island. And in the middle of the night, again, the wind came up and we got blown back to Lipari. When we got back to Lipari, every boat that was in the Aeolian Islands had headed back to Lipari because it was the only safe anchorage in the Aeolian Islands. And we ended up having to anchor in deep water, over 100-foot anchorage, which is difficult when you're pulling up, 300 feet of chain by hand. The first time I dropped the anchor, I started sliding back, and there was a boat behind me, and the man was up there rightly to be concerned that I was going to slide down on him. So I ended up having to pull the anchor up by hand. The next time I went and I got in as close to the shore as I could, and the wind was coming consistently from one direction, which was blowing me back into this sort of little bay. And as long as the wind kept blowing from that direction, I was fine. Well, we anchored. The wind blew all day long, all night long, all day the next day, all night the next night. And the next day it was still blowing, and I decided to take the dinghy and go to shore and wander around, and I spent a couple hours on shore. When I got back to the boat, the wind had shifted, and my boat was no longer where I thought it was supposed to be. Fortunately for me, there was a man and a Frenchman in a catamaran that had saw my boat drifting off and had gone over in his dinghy and towed it over and tied me up against another fishing boat. So we are all the beneficiary of the kindness of strangers, and I'll never forget that experience. The wind did eventually break, and we continued on our sailing over to the town of Cefalu, and Norman and Lynn left me from there. All right, that finishes up the stories I'm going to tell today. I could go on and on and on and on forever because I've just barely scratched the surface, of the stories that I have to tell of the years and years of sailing I've had in the Mediterranean, but I'm going to open it up for questions right now. All right, that's going to finish up this podcast. I'm going to probably try to record the question and answer session and just add that on to this podcast. If you would like to ask questions, send me an email, franz@medsailor.com, franz@medsailor.com. I like to respond to questions. It's an easy way to put together a podcast, and your questions jog my memory, and usually I can tell a story along with the questions. I'd like that. That'll finish up today's podcast. Thanks for listening.